Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed. Except this time out, I've actually waited. It's been over a week. Like, I finished this book last Saturday, and now it's Tuesday, so it's been 10 days or so since I finished this audiobook, and I haven't got round to reviewing it until today. The reason for that is that over the past few months, I've been working on an album of music and comedy songs that have, comedy songs that I've been writing and recording over the last few years, and I put together this album. It's called Bitterly Autobiographical, and last Wednesday was the album launch party, so I was doing a lot of preparation for that, and then after that, I've been busy with other things as well. So if you, the album launch party was a success, and if you actually want to listen to this album, you can find it on iTunes. You can search for Bitterly Autobiographical, that's the album name, or my name on iTunes, and also on Amazon MP3 store. So check that out if you're interested. So the book that I'm going to be reviewing today, I listened to as an audiobook, and specifically as an audiobook this time. I didn't want to read it as an ebook. It's because me and Jesse from the SFF Audio podcast, we were doing an interview or a discussion with Simon Vance, who is a very good audiobook narrator. You'd have heard stuff. You'd have heard me talking about him when we did the Dune episode. He did the Dune audiobook and also The Prestige and a number of other books that I've listened to and reviewed, I'm sure. And so at the end of that, we said, hey, what recent audiobook have you recorded, science fiction, fantasy style, that you would recommend to me, to my listeners, or whatever like that? And we'd asked the same question of Jonathan Davis when me and Jesse talked to him, and he suggested The Scar, which was a book that I really enjoyed. I rated it quite highly, if I remember. Like, not 5 stars, I'm not sure, but, you know, pretty highly. And Simon Vance said, well, there's a series that I've just recorded. It's not, you know, deep or groundbreaking in any way, but it's a lot of fun. You'll probably enjoy it. It's called The Darwin Elevator by Jason M. Hoff. Let me just make sure I've got that name right. Yes, well, I'm going to say Jason M. Hoff. It could be Jason M. Howe or Jason M. Who or Jason M. whatever, but let's call him Jason M. Hoff. And the reason he just recorded all three of these books is because the publisher has put them out 1 month after the other. Normally these trilogies come out and it's like one book and then the next year you wait and then there's another book and the next year comes out and then there's another book the next year. But here the first one was released this July, so you could buy it in July. Yeah, it says here, published 30th of July. And the next one in the Dire Earth Cycle, number 2, I don't have the name in front of me here. Oh yeah, The Exodus Towers, that came out in August. And then The Plague Force came out in September. So if you want, and you enjoyed the first book, you can just read them all the way through, or let's even listen to the audiobooks all the way through. So let's get on to the book itself. That's the reason why I read it. So the setup of this book, I would say it's quite simple, but it's not that it's simple. It's just that, like, in the blurb that you read on the back of the book, or in, like, the when Simon Vance recommended it to us, he pretty much said, okay, the Earth in the future, blah, 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 a space elevator just turns up. Some alien spaceship turns up and just drops a tether, space elevator tether, all the way down to Earth, and it sticks in Darwin, which is in Northern Australia. And so Darwin gets a space elevator, and that's why the book is called The Darwin Elevator. It's got nothing to do with evolution or Darwin as a person, except Darwin is named after Darwin, I guess. That's there. And then 8 years later, or however many years later, a zombie plague breaks out, a bit like, you know, your rage plague or your rage disease in, is it in 28 Days Later, or the Reavers or something like that from your Firefly Serenity thing. So there's lots of what they call in this book subs, which are pretty much, well, they're not zombies, but, you know, they're kind of zombies. They kind of go, well, brains. But, you know, there's some of them that, the idea being that each zombie or each subhuman, whatever they're feeling at the time that they're, or well, maybe not whatever they're feeling, but one single emotion breaks out and takes control. So if they're angry, they become full of anger, and if they're funny, or if they're, you know, if they're in a good mood, they become full of joy, and if they're feelings, if sexy, they become full of lust. And of course, the ones that are angry and stuff, they survive because they're all up for fighting and things. So years go by, and the world is full of zombies. Of course, about 90% of the people die, 10% of the people 10% of the people turn into these zombies. So it's not as if there's like 7 billion zombies. It's like, you know, the population is reduced. Of course, I'm going into a lot more detail than Simon Vance did, but he just said, okay, there's a space elevator, and then there's a zombie plague outbreak thing, but there's an aura around the space elevator which makes the zombie plague non-deadly, or it just halts the zombie plague in anyone who gets within, I think it's 8 kilometers of the space elevator. And you'd think that's the setup for the story. It is kind of the setup for the story, but that's pretty much the setting, you know. Darwin has become the last place where humans can live on Earth, on the surface of the Earth, without being, you know, without turning into zombies, into what they call subs, the subhumans in this book. So yeah, that's the thing. You've got these different kind of mix of elements. You've got zombies and post-apocalypse kind of thing going on, which leads into, so if you need to shoot lots of people up, if you need to kill lots of people, well, killing people isn't that fun, because, you know, people are real people. You need to, you know, that you don't want to have human enemies. So if you just want to shoot lots of people, well, let's have a zombie horde come in, or let's go zombie hunting or subhuman hunting. So that works pretty well. And you've got the space elevator, which brings in, like, I would say this is very influenced by Arthur C. Clarke, not just because there's a space elevator, like your Fountains of Paradise kind of stuff. Fountains of Paradise, I'll get into something else later. But anyway, you got your Fountains of Paradise style space elevator, which you can use to climb up into space. But also in the background of this, there's a whole other, like, I'll call it the subplot, but it's kind of the main plot, because the builders, which they say, oh, the builders came and built the space elevator. But the builders have been coming and going, first of all, when the space elevator came, and then again when the plague came, the builders kind of came back again. And there's this whole thing with Neil, what's his name? I made a note of this character's name. His name is Neil Platz. And Neil Platz was the guy who just happened to own, you know, just randomly happened to own the place where the space elevator touched down. And his father was already a businessman, and they had lots of, you know, industries in Darwin, and they suddenly were like, ah, now we control the gateway into space. And Neil Platz is like the guy, is the main guy who is controlling everything, controlling everything in space, and used to control everything down in Darwin until the zombie plague broke out, and then he escaped up into the geostationary orbit at the top of the space elevator. What I liked about his story, in that he's always like, he's slightly concerned about about what's happening down on Earth with the apocalypse, but he has this interaction with the builders, and we get some backstory with him of his past experiences with the builders. And it's not just that it feels, you know, like Arthur C. Clarke in terms of the you know, the space elevator, but also very much of the kind of Rendezvous with Varma thing. You know, there are times when he goes and they go and investigate an alien object, and it's very mysterious, and they're not quite sure, and they're like, well, is the alien trying to communicate with us or anything like that? And that takes up, you know, that, I thought that was one of the more interesting parts of the book, mainly because by the time we get to the end of this story, don't want to give too much away, but this is only the first book of 3 books in the Dire Earth cycle, or the Dire Earth series. What's it going to be? Let me look at it up here. The Darwin Elevated Dire Earth cycle. Oh yeah, so it is a cycle. And so by the end of this, even though we get a lot of story, we get a lot of politics, we got a lot of action, we got a lot of the, you know, our main characters running around doing zombie stuff and running around in space, what happens at the end, some of the mystery is kind of resolved. We do get like a more backstory of humans' interaction with the builders, but there's still like, oh, well, what's going to happen in the future? And we know that something else is going to happen in the future, because all the time through this book, we, you know, one of the big questions is, are the builders going to come back? And when are they going to come back? And when they do come back, what's going to happen? What's going to be the next step when the builders come back again? And so that kind of mysterious aspect kind of brought up some of the stuff that I liked the most about, about the Rendezvous with Varma. Hopefully, though, the mystery either remains or the payoff is a good mystery, because one thing that I really didn't like about the continuation of the Rendezvous with Varma, with the whole Rama series, you know, with the Rama 2 and Gardens of Rama, whatever it is, you know, they kind of tail off. And once you actually discovered what the point of Rama was, you're like, now it was more interesting when it was still mysterious. And hopefully this series keeps it either mysterious or has a good payoff. And I think actually this probably will have a good payoff, because I thought when Rama was written, I'm not saying that Arthur C. Clarke didn't have a solution or didn't have the real reason why the Rama people turned up, or the Rama spaceship came by, but it was it's kind of important that when he wrote that book, it was never meant to be solved. You know, there was never meant to be a big a big reveal later on down in the series. There was the last line which says, "Oh, the Ramans, they always built everything in threes, so maybe we'll expect another two Ramas after the first Rama." That was never written in the first draft. That was just something he thought, "Oh, just drop this in. It might be a little bit mysterious, you know, for later on." So hopefully the as you read through this series into the second and third book, the big payoff comes. So what else do we have? Yeah, you got the zombies. Post-apocalypse. Oh yeah, and also you've got, like, because there's a space elevator, there's different like levels of power and different levels of politics. Of course, everyone in the Earth tried to get to Darwin. Lots of people did get to Darwin. As soon as they got into within 8 kilometers of the Darwin elevator, the disease that might have been in them or wasn't in them stops, and they're all just living there. So there's, you know, all the squalor. I mean, there's walls around the elevator itself. And there's a character called, what's his name again? Blackfield, Russell Blackfield. And he is in charge down in, at the base of the elevator. Now, when we're talking about characters in the book, there are a few characters that I liked in here. In fact, most of the characters are pretty interesting. But there was this guy becomes the main bad guy, this Warren Blackfield. And when he was first there, I thought he was just going to be some, you know, low-level lackey. I thought he was just going to be some ignorant guy who just happened to be in power. But as it goes through, it turns out he gets more and more power. And I'm just like, but this guy's an idiot. He's never read a book. He's totally sexist. He's totally racist. Everything about him is despicable. And unfortunately, we spend... in some ways, it's quite fun for him to be the viewpoint character in some points, because you're like, oh yeah, this is a bad guy, really don't like him. But I would have liked a slightly more complex bad guy antagonist in this book. You know, there's some people who you're thinking, oh well, this person is just involved in this because of politics, or this person involved here because they're worried about the Earth, and this councilman is like doing this. But in some ways, suddenly you're like, ah, okay, this guy is just bad. So I think that's what maybe Simon Vance was saying about this book, is that it's not really complex. You know, there's not a lot of complexity in, like, the, you know, who are the bad guys? Who are the good guys? No, we know, right at the beginning of this book, who the good guys are. The good guys are, you know, this person, and the bad guys are this person. Like, there is this Neil Platts, who is kind of like this... the guy controlling everything up in space, and you think, well, is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? He's obviously done bad things in the past. He's done stuff which he isn't very proud of. Warren Blackfield. I mean, just the name Blackfield. Everybody else has like really cool names, like the main character Skylar Lucan, and people make Luke Skywalker jokes about his name and things. It's like, well, of course he's the good guy, you know. And these other and there's a very beautiful woman called Dr. Tanya Sharma, and it's like, well, of course she's beautiful. She's too beautiful. She's perfect. Of course she is going to become she's going to be like a good guy. And there's other people who you think are going to be good guys, and they are good guys. But like Blackfield, yeah, a little bit boring. I wish he'd had a little bit more depth. But rather than just kind of using his thuggishness to get through, and there's someone who kind of starts cooperating, and it's like, no, don't, he's obviously an idiot, don't, you know, he's obviously in it only for himself, he just wants more power for himself, even though I'm not quite sure why he would want more power for himself. Well, I can see why, but like, why would anybody ever grant him more power? I thought that character could have been a little bit more complex to make the bad guy a bit more believable. Anyway, the other characters, yeah, we've got Skylar Lucan. He was a pilot of a scavenger aircraft thing. So they've got this really cool vertical takeoff and landing kind of craft, Because this is in the future. Anyway, there's a craft. It's an old thing, but Skylar is a pilot, and there's, you know, Samantha was the, you know, the heavy. She was the one who would go in and kick ass, and there was another guy, I can't remember his name, and he was a... I say was, it's not as if I'm talking in the past, but like before the book, there was this crew that was together, and the captain of the crew, the guy who was in charge, decided, well, I'm not going to be the captain anymore, and he just walked out into the zombie apocalypse wasteland and never came back. Not because he died, no, that's not the point, because what makes this scavenger crew really special is that these are all immune people. Skylar and Samantha and there's the Japanese technician guy and this and the sniper guy and these other guys. They were all they're all immune to the subhuman, the subs disease, and that means that when they go out from the aura, they don't have to wear these kind of spacesuit, clean suit kind of things to stop them getting the disease. So when their captain, I can't remember his name now, he walks out on them and just goes out and is like, oh, not doing this anymore. And I'm thinking he's going to come back in book number two or number three. And I'm sure in book number two and number three, we'll find out that some of the other characters are also immune to the disease, but we'll see how that goes. Anyway, Skylar, because he was a pilot, it's just like by default, he becomes the leader of this group of scavengers who go out, you know, in their little plane all the time, and their dropship, I think they call it, you know, because they to get a long distance away from Darwin, they climb the space elevator with, you know, they attach their plane to a thing that pulls them up the space elevator, and then they can fly high, like long distance from not the top of the elevator, but from above the atmosphere, and then they drop down, like they go to a trip to Hawaii, so they drop down into Hawaii, and then they have to fly back all the way. But you know, as long as they can fly back from somewhere, they can get there without spending too much fuel. Anyway, Skylar by default becomes the leader, and he's not a very good leader at the beginning of this book. He's just like, well, I'm just a guy, I'm not very good. And this is a very interesting dynamic. And of course, you can see like you can see where the book is going to go with this, and what Skylar Lucan's character, what, you know, where he's going to go. Is he going to be a leader by the end of the book? Well, we'll just have to see. Are his crew who disrespect him at the beginning, are they going to respect him by the end? Well, we're just going to have to see about that as well. Now, I'm guessing that Skylar Lucan is the guy who's meant to be portrayed on the front of this book. Now, when I look here on your Amazon page for the Darwin Elevator, and there's this really young guy, this good-looking guy with muscles and a machine gun, they're really going, yeah, it's, you know, military science fiction. There's a guy who drops out, he jumps out of spacesuits and, you know, and he jumps out of a spaceship, from the elevator, and then he does this and does that, and it's really cool. And here he looks quite young and like maybe late 20s or something. That's not how I pictured him at all, and certainly not how Simon Vance, the audiobook narrator, plays him. He seems to play him as much, not so much older, but much more kind of mature, and his inexperience of being a leader and is like his reticence at being a leader kind of comes from his knowledge that he isn't a good leader. It's not just because, oh, I'm too young, nobody should follow me, I'm just too young, we need like someone more older. No, he is experienced, he's good at his job, and because he's good at his job, he knows that he's not good at this other job that he's suddenly got to do, even though, you know, he doesn't want to do it. And yeah, like I say, the voice that Simon Vance has for him, he always kind of like pauses before he says something. It's like, oh, this guy isn't just a like, hey, yeah, my name's Skylar Lucan and I'm going to go with it. It's more like, ah, yes, well, I think I should, you know, just taking it slower, taking it down a notch. And it gives a lot more gravitas, a lot more weight to a character, which could otherwise be like very, well, I wouldn't say bland, but, you know, kind of a bit too obvious to be played as young as the very, very obvious front cover of this book kind of makes Skylar Lucan out to be. The only problem that I have with Simon Vance, and I know it's bad because he actually recommended this book to me, is that Skylar Lucan is meant to be Dutch. And I'm not an expert at the Dutch language, but when he first turned up, I just presumed he was meant to be South African, because I know Afrikaans in South Africa, you know, there is a bit of a Dutch influence there, but I just presumed, oh, this guy's meant to be South African, and then not. And then later in the book, it's just like, is Simon Vance now doing like a Japanese accent? Just like, oh, my name here, you go here. And I'm like, okay, what's, like, what's going on there with that accent? Otherwise, I think the accents are done pretty well. All of the performances are done, like I say, when you've got someone like Simon Vance doing an audiobook, even for a popcorn kind of book like this, a popcorn kind of story, like I say, it does bring extra weight and gravitas to the book. I'm reading Ian M. Banks at the moment, that's why I have gravitas on my brain. Anyway, so what other characters do we have? Oh yeah, we've got Tanya Sharma, who's the beautiful scientist. She was interesting to begin with. Later on, I was thinking, oh no, there's going to be some love interest, and then she's going to be the damsel in distress, and kind of happens, which is a bit annoying. But then after, there's also some other female characters, like there's Samantha and I think Natalie, Kelly. Anyway, I was confused by some of these other names. Samantha, I didn't, because, you know, she had her own role and she was introduced as a character. But then there was Tanya and Natalie and Kelly, and and there was a few other characters, and I was just like, some of these names, they're not too similar. I mean, of course, you can tell the difference between Tanya and Natalie, but like, when I'm listening to this as an audiobook, I don't, you know, I'm not seeing the shape. I don't remember their first and second names exactly. And sometimes the different characters, when a name was mentioned, I was like, oh, was that Kelly or Natalie? Are we talking about Kelly or Natalie here? Who's the one who knows Tanya? And at one point, they described Tanya, and I thought Natalie was being described, and I was like, oh, so Natalie is the one who has the father from India who was really beautiful, and then later on, I get this other thing. I was like, oh no, that must have been Tanya. Oh, all the time, I thought they described Natalie. So I think if these other female characters had been like, I think that's the weird thing, is that like Natalie. No, sorry, Samantha and Tanya were described physically, whereas Natalie was never really described. She had like a plot function and a friendship kind of character. And Kelly had a bit as well, but I was always a bit confused when one of these female names was mentioned, who was who. But that's not just a female thing. That did actually happen a bit with some of the other characters as well. There was Russell Blackfield, and I think there's a Warren. And I got, okay, so which one's Warren and which one's Russell? Which, you know, sometimes, you know, it's like, okay, they both have similar functions in the plot, or maybe not with these two, but yeah. It would have been nice to sometimes have a little bit more clarity there. So, what else? Yeah. Oh yeah, Tanya. She's a scientist, a beautiful scientist, and her job is to discover something which Neil Platt already knows, but he's trying to like make sure that somebody finds out something. And this is all described in like the first few chapters of the book, so I'm not really giving anything away. But it was quite annoying that these two main characters, Skylar Lucan and Tanya Sharma, Dr. Tanya Sharma, a lot of the time they were doing stuff which was important, but which could have already been known. Like, Neil Platt could have found all this out a long time ago, or already knew a lot of the stuff that these people were working really hard. So sometimes it's difficult. Oh, we're going to go on a mission to Hawaii. And I'm like, yeah, but when you get there, you're going to find something that you already know. You know, like, where's the drama of this? Or like, where's the sacrifice? Because you don't already know it, but somebody else already knows it. And this is just kind of like a diversion, or like a subterfuge kind of thing, this whole reason that you're being used. Of course, later on, they are actually learning new stuff and getting into scrapes and things. So, so a lot of the action takes place in and around Darwin. There's another character, I can't remember his name now, but like the guy who's the black marketeer, I really enjoyed his character as well. And the reason is like, yes, one day I'll retire and I'll buy this coffee shop. There's some really fun character moments, and you know, they're doing stuff in the sewers and doing stuff in the slums and doing stuff down there in Darwin, where there's, you know, millions of people all living within this tiny little area. And that's good. And going out into the other situation, you know, into the wider world, where the situation is all like post-apocalypse, and also the space elevator starts breaking a little bit, you know, all these different things. Is really, I really enjoyed all of the action. The character interaction was generally good. I'm not really sure what else to say about this. You know, the characters are good. It's all fun. The action is good. Like, normally I talk about the themes, but like it's difficult to kind of talk about that. Of course, there's themes of power and, you know, taking power, and is power knowledge or is power might? You know, there's one thing that the guy looks around and goes, oh, well, we could get here and we could bring up lots of different things. You know, we could bring up into this elevator, I could bring up loads and loads of men with guns and we could take over. And then you think, well, what's going to happen at the end of this book? Are these going to bring up lots of people with guns and take over? I'm not really sure. So yeah, like, is knowledge power, is might power, there's those kind of things going into it. But with like, yeah, like with the military science fiction kind of stuff, I guess that's going to be part of it. Lots of parachute drops, lots of sniping, lots of gun battles. Yeah, like I said at the beginning, like if you want to shoot lots of people, you've got to make sure that they're either Nazis or zombies, and then you don't feel bad about shooting them. And what I liked about the beginning of this book is that it starts off with that. It's like, yes, we're going to kill lots of people, but they're subhumans. They're not really humans. And then later on, you're thinking, well, are they humans? Can they be just like that? But by the time that you're worrying a little bit about the subhumans, then there's other action, and then real humans are being killed. But by then, you're like, yes, those humans should die. I guess that's what we're meant to be thinking. But I do like a lot of military science fiction seems to be based around sort of like, and then this ship is going to attack that ship, and then this ship is going to attack this. What I liked about this is it felt like near the end, it's like, okay, we're on this orbital station, and how do we get from this orbital station down to this orbital station or across to this orbital station? And then once we get there, how do we get through an airlock? You know, it seems to be kind of grounded very much in like, and that's what I liked about it. It was sometimes a little bit vague. It's like, oh, so where are they going from here to there? But generally, it was pretty well written, and you know, the action that was taking place on the spaceships. What other characters have I got here? No, let's give it that way. Samantha kicks ass. Kelly kicks ass. Some really good characters there. Yeah, I think that's up with the characters. Okay, on to a few problems that I have with this. First of all, well, not problem, about with the technology and the technical stuff. What I really like about this book, not a problem, but what I really do like, is the idea that Earth gets a space elevator, but humans don't build the space elevator. And that's really cool. The reason why that's really cool is because if you have a situation where humans on Earth have managed to get enough technology to be able to work out how to build a space elevator, and they've got enough infrastructure in space to be able to make a space elevator in space and drop it down to Earth, it means that we're we're already in space. We're already doing stuff in space, and we don't need to worry too much about Earth, because it'll be a book then about climbing to the stars and going to Mars and heading to the moon. In this book, though, humans have really kind of turned their back on space and not really interested in it until the space elevator comes along and drops down a tether. And that's all it does. It's a tether, it's a space station, there's the anchor station right at the very top, and then there's a tether that comes all the way down, places itself in Darwin. And then it's the humans themselves who take electricity that comes from the space elevator to power cars that climb up these little cargo pods, which have these little feet or legs or hands that kind of grip hold of the tether and pull themselves up. And they can only go one way at a time, because when there's pods are going upwards, there's no way to cross over. So they send lots of pods up, and then once they get to the top, then they send pods down. And food comes down from the orbital factories, you know, not factories, but yeah, factories and greenhouses. And then from Earth, water and air goes back up to do all that, because they can't do any farming down on Earth, because it's too dangerous, you know, and it doesn't work that way. So food comes down, air and water goes up, but only one way. So that's a pretty cool thing that they've set up there. However, my problem with space elevator, first of all, is that I always thought that space elevators have to touch down at the equator, because what's keeping them up is either something in geostationary orbit, which is coming down and dropping something down onto Earth, which is fair enough, that's no problem at all. It's something that's out past geostationary orbit, like the tether itself goes out past geostationary orbit to kind of balance it out, so it's kind of tethered to the Earth, and then it sticks out in this kind of swinging round. And like I say, I thought it had to touch down at the equator, and I thought that's the reason why in the Fountains of Paradise that Arthur C. Clarke doesn't only have the space elevator touch down in Sri Lanka, which is very close to the equator, but it touches down in a fictional Sri Lanka, which is actually a little bit further south and is actually on the equator. Let me just look at my world map there. Yeah, no, Sri Lanka isn't on the equator, but I think in the Fountains of Paradise, like, Arthur C. Clarke, he knows exactly where Sri Lanka is because he lived there. But he just says, oh yeah, Sri Lanka is on the equator, and it isn't, but he just said it is, and then the physics works. So for Arthur C. Clarke, the physics of the space elevator was more important than that was more important than geographical realities. Now, Darwin is is close to the equator, but I think the equator is a little bit too far north. But that isn't mentioned in this book. You know, and all these, you know, space elevators that you read about on Mars, in like Red Mars or Green Mars or Blue Mars, wherever the space elevator comes in, always touches down in the equator. There's another book that I remember where they do stuff and they launch from Mount Kenya, which is like 1 degree north of the equator. And there's another book that I remember, and the space elevator comes down at the mouth of the Amazon, which is right on the equator. You know, there's that seems to be like a main feature of space elevator books, is that stuff comes down and they are tethered to the equator. In this book, it doesn't. And then I was thinking all the time, like, well, if the thing is in geostationary orbit, the whole point is a geostationary orbit, that it's the, you know, the 40,000 kilometers or however far it is above the equator. Because then when you point your satellite dish at the equator or at one of these things in geostationary orbit, it's pointing to a point 40,000 kilometers above the equator, which means that that's how radio telecommunication works. So if they're like you, and you can tell this like by when you go to the anywhere in the equator and you look at the TV dishes, you know, the your satellite TV dishes on roofs on the equator, they're all pointing exactly straight up. And the further north or south you go, the further down, or sort of like the more tipped over they are. And when you get really far north, they're kind of tipped over directly towards the horizon, because that is the point where the satellites are in geostationary orbit. Now, all of this is to say that if the space elevator did touch down in Darwin, it would mean that the space elevator anchor wouldn't be directly above Darwin, and the elevator wouldn't climb directly up and down. It would be like an angle pointing in the same angle that would be where the satellite dishes point in Darwin. That's the angle that the thing you'd be sitting at. Anyway, while I'm reading this book, I'm thinking, is this just a mistake, or am I not understanding space elevators correctly? Because, to be honest, I haven't done any more research since reading the book, but if I've got this completely wrong, like Larboard and Starboard in my last review, yes, you can stop emailing me and Twittering me and sending me messages. I know that Larboard was a nautical term. But the reason it was changed is because it's confusing, like it was confusing in the book that I reviewed last time out. Anyway, the other thing that I'm getting mixed up about with the space elevator is that, like, space elevator, like, they start climbing the space elevator, and as far as I knew, space elevators have gravity all the way up until you get into geostationary orbit, because the point is, the speed that they're going, anything less than the geostationary orbit means that you are now not relying on orbital mechanics to give you no gravity, you're actually just relying on the strength of the tether. That's what makes it such an engineering problem. You can't just float it in space. And there's points in this book where they're going, right, we're getting, you know, Skylar and his crew gets into their little spaceship plane thing, and they start climbing the space elevator, and it takes them hours and hours, not like 10 hours, but after 10 hours, they get above the atmosphere, and they're like floating around in zero gravity. And I'm like, no, look, if you're in orbit 100 kilometers up, yes, you would be in zero gravity, or maybe 200 kilometers or however far up they go, you would be in zero gravity if you're in orbit there. But if you're in a space elevator, sure, there will be less gravity if you go 200 kilometers up. Of course, you actually have to calibrate, you know, specific, you know, scales on elevation, because the further away from the center of the Earth you get, the gravity does slack off. But 100 kilometers or 200 kilometers up is not going to give you anything like zero gravity. Not at all. So that was something that was going wrong. And then there's when they're out the other end, of course, when they're at the anchor station, there is zero gravity. But then I'm thinking, but if you go out further than the anchor point or from geostationary orbit, then you get gravity going in the other way. And it was making me think, well, then, like, you're going to be, you know, if you get far enough away, it's going to be a swinging thing, the centrifugal force or whatever it is. And anyway, so that was another thing which is just wrong in this book. You don't get zero gravity if you're 100 kilometers up a space elevator. And there was a few other things as well, which I was looking at and going, really, does that work that way? And I was thinking, well, is he just changing physics for the sake of the story, or does he not understand the physics? I got a little bit confused. Like, for example, it says at some point Darwin was just a beach town. Now, I've been to Darwin, and I was said, hey, shall I go to the beach? And someone said, oh no, don't go to the beach. The reason I shouldn't go to the beach is for these reasons: sharks, box jellyfish, and saltwater crocodiles. The three most deadly things in the sea, all there in Darwin. That might have been Cairns, and it might have just been the time of year, but it made me think, like, if I was going to describe Darwin, I wouldn't describe it as a beach town, even if it is a beach town, like, I wouldn't be going in the water there as well. Maybe that's me just not remembering properly. Maybe I'm thinking about Cairns instead of Darwin, but there are these small little, you know, these little things. What else have I got here? Yeah, anyway, so just some general physics problems, which I know must be problems. Like, it must have been like, Arthur C. Clarke didn't move Sri Lanka, you know, 500 kilometers south, just on a whim. He did it because I think elevators need to come down in, you know, at the right spot, and, you know, knowing gravity, how gravity works, is also pretty important. However, despite my problems with some of the physics, despite my problems with some of the characters, overall, I thought this was a really good fun read. It's, you know, it's fast-paced, the characters are fun, you know, they're doing fun stuff, the whole mystery of the builders is really good, the action is good, the zombies are fun, yeah, all good fun. And some people make it through to the end of the book, some people don't. Sometimes I'm thinking, oh, I hope these two people have some kind of romantic liaison, rather these two boring people. You know, there is not a lot of complexity in this book. But however, this book was not sold on me on the complex plot or the complex characters or the complex science or anything like that. It was sold to me as, hey, this is a fun book. Check it out. Read it. And it is a fun book. It's good, fun, zombie, space elevator, military, science fiction with people jumping out of airplanes and shooting zombies with sniper rifles and blowing stuff up and jumping around in zero gravity and doing stuff in orbit. Good fun stuff. So I probably will. I mean, the next two books are out already. I'll probably get to them. Not straight away, but, you know, I'll probably get to them at some point because it is a fun thing. Thanks, Simon Vance, for recommending it. You can listen to this book for free if you want to. You can check out audibletrial.com/SFBRP and start an Audible trial, and that helps support the SFBRP and me and the hosting costs and stuff for this podcast. If you want to help out, that's great. If you don't, that's great as well, but I would suggest check it out. Get a free audiobook, audibletrial.com/SFBRP, and that free trial might as well be The Darwin Elevator by Jason M. Hoff. Anyway, I think that's it for this book. Again, not too much to say about it. It's not that complex, but I enjoyed it a lot. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars. Maybe if the series continues on, it would go up in my estimation, like the series itself. But, you know, there's nothing to complain about in this book except some physics and boring antagonists. Well, not boring antagonists. Fun antagonists, but slightly unsatisfying antagonists. And damsels in distress. I watched Despicable Me 2 last night, and I'm just like, well, I bet she has to be saved from being tied up later on, and guess what? Yes, she has to be saved from being tied up later on. You're just like, well, why couldn't it be the other way around? Why can't she save the guy? Why can't the girl save the guy? Oh, all the time. Damsel in distress. Right then, that's it for me. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burridge. You can check out my website. It's lukeburridge.com, and my blog there is full of all sorts of kind of stuff. You can check out my own fiction at that same website, what else? Yeah, all kinds of good stuff. You can what do I normally say? Yeah, oh yeah, and also you can check out my new album that's been released as well, Bitterly Autobiographical. Find it on iTunes or Amazon MP3 store. It's lots of fun songs and stuff. I think you'll enjoy it. Anyway, that's it for me. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.